Hello, and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies, and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Jeremy Shapiro. I'm the research director of ECFR, and this is possibly also the last episode in my attempted coup of this podcast while Mark is on sabbatical. So it's up to you to give us good reviews so that the coup can succeed. And this week's podcast, incredibly appropriately, will be about Africa and global order. We're recording this in Berlin on the sidelines of ECFR's annual Berlin Africa Forum, which brings together distinguished African and European policymakers and thinkers for discussions on the two continents' strategic partnership or lack thereof in the changing global order. With me here today, we have a distinguished cast. We have Adebayo Olukoshi, Brian Kagoro, and Theo Murphy. Adebayo is the distinguished research professor, not merely a research professor, at the Wits School of Governance in South Africa and the former director of International IDEA, which is an intergovernmental organization that supports democracy worldwide. Brian is the managing director of programs at the Open Society Foundations, which is a funder of ours, so thank you, Brian. And Theo Murphy, as you probably all know, is director of ECFR's Africa program. So to kick us off, here at ECFR, we've been doing a lot of thinking recently about world order and the growing role of what we like to call middle powers, which is basically anybody that we have to pay attention to that isn't the United States and China. So we found a lot of times that these discussions about middle powers overlook Africa, of course, not at ECFR. So just to start with you, Theo, why is Africa overlooked so frequently? And why can we as Europeans, and is that a bad idea, I guess, is the question. What does Africa have that Europe wants and needs? And before you answer that question, I can almost hear the pedants in our audience telling me that Africa is a continent and Europe is a continent. We know that. We learned it in school. What we're trying to have a generalization that is useful, not totally accurate. And we do understand that there are a lot of countries in both Europe and Africa that have their own distinct characteristics. Having said that, we will never mention them again. Theo.
Thanks for that caveat, Jeremy. That gets that out of the way. And the only way we can have a halfway succinct conversation about Africa and Europe is if we generalize. So I'm glad you gave us carte blanche to do that.
Please do.
Look, I think one of the reasons that Africa doesn't feature as prominently as it should in European thinking about Europe's interests and about changing global order is that Africa is too often derivative of other European interests. So Europe pursues a priority interest in Ukraine, with Ukraine and Russia. And it sees Africa as derivative, as subsidiary to that. So it's not about Africa as a subject, a principal subject of the relationship, but it's about getting Africa on board for what Europe already wants to do in place X. And it's not just in Ukraine. That also goes for things like climate, which is a universalist project that Europe pursues. Europe crafts an approach to it and then sees that Africa should share that approach. And goes to Africa with a sort of ready-made policy prescription and says, please be grateful and sign on to it. But the reason that particularly in the Berlin Africa Forum you just mentioned, we focus on global order is that I think there's unrealized potential there between the two continents. And we haven't seen it because the superficial differences between us as continents have disguised it. Put shortly, I think it turns out that as global order changes, Europe and Africa find themselves more in a similar strategic position than either realizes. I think actually, we're going to use a relationship metaphor here. Africa has a clearer sense of where things are going. And because of that clearer sense, has adopted a polyamorous approach to global order. And that approach is dictated by the fact that the rules-based order, as we like to call it, hailing from 1945 onwards, is seen by many parts of the world, Africa included, to be something that is fraying at the edges, maybe terminally so. In that situation, I think Africa has wisely said or thought to itself, we're not exactly sure what is coming next. We see increasing competition between the great powers, China and the US, but also, interestingly, between rising middle powers who are interested in Africa as well. And it behooves us as Africa, in order to pursue our primary interest, which is absolutely economic development, to keep our relations open as much as possible with all sides. Or to put it another way, to absolutely avoid being shut off from having any relationships, cut off from it, which is what Europe asked Africa to do over the Ukraine war.
Polyamory, that's more exciting than I thought the global order would get. Adebayo, when I hear Africans talk about the global order, I hear a lot of, I guess the most kind way I could put it is displeasure. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, they feel as if it's been, as Theo said, an exploitative relationship. And so I'm wondering, do you see it that way? Why do Africans feel this way, if they do? And do you see, do you agree with Theo that this attitude to order is changing, in the sense that the Africans feel like they have an opportunity in the new reality emerging?
No, absolutely. It's displeasure that has deep roots in history, going back to the slave trade, colonialism, and in the post-independence period, a lot of what is considered to be inbuilt disadvantage that basically prevents Africa from realizing its full potentiality, especially with regard to economic transformation. From the point of view of history...
Can you be a little bit specific about how the order prevents Africa from realizing its potential?
I'll do that. From the point of view of history, the issues of unresolved reparations for slave trade back on the table in a big way. There were colonial crimes, including episodes of genocide from Namibia to Tanzania and elsewhere on the continent. There are issues of restitution.
These seem to be issues of justice rather than issues of economic development. So,
they are combined in a certain sense, because the depopulation of the continent during the slave trade was actually the beginning of the underdevelopment of the continent. And going through the colonial period and the establishment of a division of labor, in which Africa has basically remained a primary commodity producer. And in the post-independence period, that whole setup in the global trading order, which essentially, again, reproduced that role of a primary commodity producer. And for Africa, the issues of economic transformation are so important that, as you would have seen, much of the independence period devoted to arguing terms of trade improvement. Improvements in the global financial architecture, the hemorrhaging of capital from the continent, not just in terms of which many in the West tend to focus on, not just in terms of corruption, of Mobutu stashing away millions in Swiss banks, but also transfer pricing by giant multinational companies, which account for almost 80% of the illicit financial flows that the continent hemorrhages. So all of these add up together to create a feeling of dissatisfaction on the continent. Its inability to stabilize economic development and to push transformation. And I think in the context of what is changing around us in the world, there's a determination that Africa must exercise agency. This time around, in the 1940s, the current order was constructed around the victors of the Second World War led by the United States. Its hegemony in the system may have brought certain benefits like independence, Atlantic Charter, and the like. But in the end, it's that an order was designed for which Africa had no role. This time around, Africa wants to be a joint rulemaker. And there are, I think, movements which are ongoing on the continent at various levels, civil society, academia, but also significantly amongst political leaders on the continent to begin to shape an agenda around which Africa will build partnerships.
So to what I hear you saying is that the order was constructed without African agency and therefore against African, at least not taking into account African interests, and very often exploitative of Africa, and that you're determined, and most Africans are determined this time around, as the old order is fraying, to reconstruct it with greater agency and with greater attention to African interests.
Absolutely.
So maybe, Brian, you can follow up on that and say, how is it that Africans see themselves exercising that agency? What are they intending to do, but how do they intend to do it?
I think the if you build on from what Theo and Adebayo have referred to, which is that the post-1945 order sought to constrain choice by dictating values and direction and policing them, sometimes using the most egregious forms, so whether it's coup d'etat, regime change, where regimes were felt by the West to be leaning more towards a communist bent, is that that created instability. It eroded sovereignty. It sustained dependency. So that dependency was not based on choice, but also constructed amnesia over the issues that you referred to as justice. What you're seeing are three strands in Africa. The first is regional developmentalism. The idea of a very diverse continent learning to speak with one voice through the African Union. We saw that recently in the global tax reform conversations. We saw that also in the vote on Ukraine and elsewhere. Not only is this regional developmentalism anchored on an accession of sovereignty or the desire to be self-sustaining by coming up with things such as the African Continental Free Trade Agreement or Free Trade Area, freedom of movement, and the Africa Agenda 2063, which is a common uniting vision. We're seeing Africa assert itself as a critical player, demanding representation. This is not a new demand. It was the first demand in 1963 at the foundation of the OAU. But there is a subtext to what we're hearing, and this is from African young people who actually have a more radical position on the global multilateral system.
They always do.
Right. They don't think it works. They don't think that the conversation should merely be about representation in an order that's predetermined, that's bounded, that's inflexible, that juniorizes and infantilizes Africa. They think that there is need to reimagine the order based on new realities. The world has changed. The direction of the world economy, if you look at trade balance, trade indices, has changed. The direction of the world economy in terms of security and threats, shared threats, has changed. The direction of the world economy in imagining the future of energy and what it will take to sustain the world, the direction of the world economy in terms of demography has also significantly changed. And so Africa is not just demanding to be heard, it's demanding not just a seat at the table, that the table be reimagined. And that is actually there is a meeting point.
But what is the reimagination? You know, my problem with the youth is always that they have a great diagnosis of the problems of the day, but very little vision of what the tomorrow should be. So it's very easy to accept the criticisms of the current order, but that's a little bit more difficult to understand what it is, what this new vision is. What does Africa want?
Yeah. I think it's articulated clearly in Agenda 2063, and Africa has stated this. It's a multilateral system that not only protects the weak, but that also constrains the strong. current multilateral
as opposed system. To the other way around.
Yes, yeah. And then
and that does sound like a good idea.
the second bit is actually economic structural transformation. The current structure of whether it's a multilateral investment governance, multilateral trade governance, or multilateral the development finance in the development finance architecture that determines debt and other things is designed in such a way that Africa would never achieve economic structural transformation. So the system itself, so I think the critique is not just a critique of what's wrong with the system. It's an imagination that says, well, if Africa is the domicile of most of the critical minerals that are needed, not just by Europe, but that the rest of the world, then, you know, we have to have a serious conversation about the mutuality of interests. Whether it's technology transfer that we need, is the critical minerals that you want for our economic structural transformation, is value addition and industrialization. These are the things that matter to us. There will be reimagination on things such as security and et cetera. I think what the polyamorous approach essentially says this, we now have choices. We're not entirely dependent on former colonial powers, but we realize that Europe is not only made up of former colonial powers. There are countries in Europe that stood in solidarity with Africa as Africa fought for its liberation, that have their own experience of occupation, of some form of colonization. So whilst we speak generally of Europe, I think the nuance is not lost to Africa, African labor movements, African young people. But the collective demand is that this historical and current consciousness, as well as the future imperatives, must push us to reimagine together, but mindful that we all have interests. So instead of Europe hiding its interests in the assertion and policing of values, I think it must be clearer. Europe must be very clear. We want critical minerals, and we will also be very clear about what we want.
That is very clear. Thank you. It does appear as if polyamory is a sort of exciting word for I can choose. Which makes a lot of sense. But if you think about what that is, it's a somewhat more transactional approach to relations, not continental relations, but relations between African countries and European countries. So, Adebayo, I'm wondering if you see it that way as well, and if this is a more transactional approach, does that come with its own problems, or are they self-defeating, or is it your view that in the new world order, all foreign policy is ultimately transactional?
Well, it's always a transactional component to all foreign policy, and I think part of the concern in the past in Africa is that the geopolitical and economic interests of Europe are sometimes unnecessarily hidden behind so-called values.
That may have happened once or twice, yeah.
You've heard it here.
which are even on their own terms, inconsistently applied. And all of the criticisms about double standards and selectivity.
I think to me, that's quite clear, but I think it might be helpful for our audience if you give an example of that.
Well, I mean, so let's take issues of human rights or unconstitutional change of government, which is a more recent clear case. Two coups take place, one in West Africa, Mali, the other in Central Africa, Chad. The coup in Mali is condemned, sanctioned, threats are issued. And all of the works.
Because of the Malian government's relationship to Russia?
Absolutely. Well, even before the Russian link. The Russian link came after the coup, properly. But rather that one of the big players in the EU, France, more or less did not like the coup because it was carried out by people who are not necessarily directly under the influence of different establishments, and had removed one of the favorites of France in West Africa, right? Coup takes place also in Chad. And within 48 hours, President Macron is in N'Djamena endorsing the coup and praising the coup makers for reasons of strategic stability that Chad represents for the sub-region. So it's some people are like, oh, wow, okay. There are good coups and bad.
It's easy to suspect a double standard in that case. So you see, to you, that indicates that we kind of have no choice but to be more transactional in the foreign policy.
Not necessarily. I mean, as I said, there's always a transactional component in interstate relations. However, it is not that there is no room for values and for the principles derived from values. And what we hear increasingly from Africa, for example, is the need not only for a domestic Ubuntu, which you might recall Mandela talked about quite a lot. I am because you are. We're not going to get into this binary business of winner-loser, zero-sum game in international relations. If it works for you, it works for us. And it's better that we put the cards on the table and find what works for all of us on the basis of our needs, on the basis of our interests. We have concerns of a specific nature. If it works for us, it ought not be seen as a loss for you in the classic way in which...
Right. So it's not specifically transactionalism, more that you just lay on the table what it is your interests are and what you're actually trying to achieve in any given interaction.
Absolutely. And I'm framing this within a value system that promotes shared prosperity. And progress for all people, everybody in the world, all parts of the world want dignity for themselves, want mutual respect. And where there are differences, for those differences to be respected and not interpreted to mean that if you are not for us, it means you're against us.
I want that. Theo, I think you have some comments on that, but also... Adebayo and Brian have been sort of nipping at the edges of how of Europe's role in all of this. And I'd like to hear from you what you think, looking at the new deal, the new type of relationship that they're sketching out for both the world order and for relationship with Europe. What are Europe's responsibilities and capabilities to contribute to this?
Well, I think that the problem that we face in Europe and our policy towards Africa is that we lack categories for these interests. And so things get mixed up together. Things that might be transactional are dealt with as obligations or ideological. So let me be a little bit more concrete about this. I think there's one type of category, Europe, where we need something from Africa. And that's most poignant around the area of renewable energy and critical minerals. That's very clear. There's a second category where we as Europe think that there are universal objectives that we're pursuing. So here, this would be on climate. But where Africa sees that Europe's approach is disadvantaging them, we can say a little bit more about that. There's a third category, I think, which Adebayo brought up, where we could take a topic that looks like a threat to us in Europe. And this would be migration. But it would be possible to reframe it in a way that's to the advantage of both continents. And you, Adebayo, yesterday in our discussion, you were talking about population mobility rather than migration. It sounds like a semantic difference, but if we dig into it, there's something more there. And there's a fourth and final category, which are topics and interests that Africa has in the relationship that are currently not featuring. And that's what you were bringing up about reparations. They're not on the table at all. So we don't have clarity in Europe on these categories. And that means that we tend to make category order mistakes in our interactions and negotiations.
Brian, I mean, what you already alluded to it a little bit, but what are you expecting from Europeans in terms of contributing to the new vision of world order and that you outlined? And what do you think, not just their responsibilities are, but what do you think their capabilities are? Because it occurred to me as you were talking that really the polyamory that you're mostly focused on is about the U.S. and China. Does Europe have a special role there?
Yeah, I think first, I think a humility on the part of Europe.
Oh, can we do anything else?
A Europe with an aging population, faced with, bounded with an India with a surging population, and Africa that's likely to constitute a significant portion of the global population, but also that holds a significant amount of resources that Europe needs. Balancing out this East-West competition. There's going to be a competition for African resources, whatever form those resources come. What Europe has done is sometimes been inattentive to African demands that mean a lot because Europe has dismissed them as purely emotive, but they have a deep cultural and economic significance. And this is the demand around reparations. The dismissal in Europe is, well, if we actually, we just say sorry, don't accept liability. But Europe has not dealt with questions of repair that affect other civilizations the same. It would not deal with questions of repair that affect Jewish people or that affect Japanese people or that affect other civilizations the same. So there is almost a contemptuous sense that Africa can always take Europe's condescension. There's an entire generation that's arising in Africa that's more outraged because, let me give you a little anecdote. When I learned history and went to school, that would be the same for Adebayo. We did not see images of Congolese children in human zoos in Belgium. The generation now that has access to the internet is seeing graphic illustrations of what the colonial moment was, what the enslavement moment was. There's a re-victimization. So whilst they are outraged against dictatorship in their countries and kleptocracy, they are also outraged by the double standards and the hypocrisy that they see. And Europe in particular, I think, has another possibility. Europe faces the same existential crisis as does Africa, right? A Europe without any of its French colonies, without any of the African 1.3 to 2.3 billion market, who will Europe be selling what to, right? So Europe not only needs that future market in Africa, in the current conjuncture, Europe has been part of the de-skilling of Africa by, of course, Europe has need for African experts in healthcare and other but these were trained based on loans that are still being repaid that were given by Europe and others for Africa to invest in its social services. So literally Europe gives a loan, which it is being repaid for, but takes the people who are but we're going to see that this, as Europe goes to the fore, to the right, and there's a migration or the characterization, to go back to Theo and Adebayo's question, goes more and more visceral reaction to the increase of the number of Africans within Europe and etc., or the need to control particular categories of African, is going to complicate the relationship and reactivate the historical pain points, right? So what you're seeing is the racialization of the narrative based on, unwittingly, Europe's real concerns, or Europe's concerns about population movements within Europe from the continent is going to be. So if we don't talk honestly and about our interests, that's going to be a problem. And it's going to be a future problem for European domestic politics, but it's going to be a problem for European international relations or ability to relate with Africa on the basis of equal partnership, respect for sovereignty and values. Because I think there will be a questioning of the legitimacy of Europe's commitment to values domestically as there will be internationally. But there is another point I think that we ought to consider. We ought to consider that significantly Europe stopped being the manufacturing hub of the world, right? With the rise of China, of tech, or the other middle powers, the manufacturing hub of the world has moved elsewhere. So Europe has also significantly begun to experience a level of either stagnation in its industrialization mode, and it has become a finance capital, which means it's receiving finance from different parts of the world. There are European economies that are sustained largely by finance because they were the banking centers. As Saudi Arabia and other banking centers and options arise for Africa and other parts of the world, this is going to be a significant point of concern. So Africans may prefer certain things because of cultural affinity, because a lot of family members are resident within European centers. But as this relationship gets complicated, I think what's important is we are no longer in that situation where Europe is doing Africa charity or Africa is purely. Yes, there are still relations, historical relations of aid and demands for reparations and etc. But there are fundamental, future-focused, existential questions. European think tanks and African think tanks need to be collaborating to think about the next 100 years. How do we keep afloat and competitive in a world where we are becoming more and more either the site of competition or footnotes of the trajectory of development?
Thanks. That was very profound. And I think broadly what you're saying, is, if I can summarize it, is that Europe needs Africa. It needs its resources. It needs its labor. It needs its market. And it won't get it unless it deals with its past and deals with the history and even deals with the sort of emerging reinvigoration of the racialism that's coming through the immigration channel. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a profound challenge for Europe. But it's very important for us to hear. I think we could go on for quite some time, but we're already over time. So we have one thing left to do on this podcast, and that is our bookshelf section, where we ask you all what you have been reading and can recommend to our listeners. Theo, maybe we can start with you. What are you reading these days? What's on your bookshelf?
I can recommend Keepers of the Flame. It's a book by Professor Stephen Hopgood from SOAS, which I read a long time ago, but I've been feeling somewhere between religious and secular recently, and that's exactly what that book's about. It's looking at human rights as a sort of secular church, and as a dotted line to some of the conversations we've been having there, which inspired me to take that up again.
Human rights as a secular church. Suddenly it's all clear. Adebayo, what's on your bookshelf?
There's a recent book by Olufemi Taiwo. He's a philosophy professor, at Cornell University in New York. And he produced a monograph against post-colonial, against the post-colonial, which is quite provocative in the sense that much of our post-independence experience has been captured within the framework of the concept of the post-colonial. And he goes against it in an interesting way, which basically argues that part of the decolonial movement among young Africans, in the way in which Brian explained it, might be significant in seeking a new form of sovereignty for the continent, but it doesn't nearly go far enough because it continues to use the encounter with Europe as a reference point for periodizing Africa's
interesting
experience.
Which is, I suppose, what we did here today. So maybe he has a point. Brian, what's on your bookshelf? Hopefully not something that will shake our foundation so much.
I'm reading Hilary Beckel's The First Black Slave Society, Britain's Barbarity Time in Barbados, 1636 to 1876. Hilary does a biographic, narrative on the growth of certain British barons, sugar barons, and wealthy folks, and their benefit from the enslavement, but also helps us understand how at the point of emancipation, the decade of emancipation, 1833, 23 to 33, two things happened. Britain took out a loan to pay reparations to slave owners for what was allegedly loss of property, and how slaves themselves were then asked to pay the balance, 40%, through a system that was called pupillage, where they had to render labor for free, apparently to pay for their own, and which is then situates the demand for reparations, this thing that's happening in Africa and Caribbean, in a very interesting frame, because if slaves paid reparations for their own liberation, Britain actually was willing to pay the slave owners. But it also, that book helps us understand how legally the notion of black people and Africans, Afro-descendants being less than human was institutionalized. It then informed, if you catapult into the future, the decision by the British Privy Council that informed the approach of the colonial enterprise in the rest of the continent and the Caribbeans, that natives, because they were not human, blacks were not human, they had no sense of ownership. Therefore, the grabbing of land, dispossession of their wealth, could not be seen as an affront to a people because they were not a people. So it's an interesting book that frames how scholarship, how law, framed for empire, but also framed for the moment of both slavery and colonialism or colonization, this dehumanization of the other, and also dispossession as justified both by law, by politics, by morality.
Okay. Sounds a bit heavy, but very important. I think everybody should read all three of those books, and we will put a link to all the publications that were mentioned on our website at ecfr.eu. And in the meanwhile, if you have enjoyed listening to this podcast and you've enjoyed my attempted coup of it, please let other people know by writing about it on your social media page or ours. But above all, hopefully, please give us a good rating and review it on whichever platform you use to download this podcast. But for now, from Adebayo, Brian, Theo, and myself, Jeremy Shapiro, it is goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Maria Faro Saratz.